how about we don't try and make food perfect? Because it's not perfect, just like life's not perfect.
If you're recycling, that's awesome. But you also need to look at all these other pieces, and you don't have to be doing them perfectly.
The first step is reduce, then reuse, then recycle. They are in order.
Get inspired by people fighting to make this world better for everyone. This is Unwasted with Imperfect.
Hello and welcome back to the Unwasted podcast. It's my honor every week to talk with experts in food, health, sustainability, and generally making the world a better, tastier place. I think it's fair to say that plant-based protein is having a moment. COVID-19 has caused meat shortages in some parts of the U.S., while so many of us were already thinking more seriously about how our diet affects the planet. Now, many omnivores and even some avid carnivores are looking to cut down on their meat consumption while still eating the things they love. Why is this shift happening now? What does this mean for our diets and the future of our food system? Today's guests have a wealth of knowledge about meat alternatives to share with us. They're two of the folks behind Impossible Foods, a plant-based burger that's taking the world by storm. Danielle and Rebecca, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
Hey, Riley. Great to have you. Great to be here.
It's so lovely to have you both on the podcast. I always love having two guests. I think it's just a more exciting, fun, dynamic energy. And the idea of talking about plant-based meats today, I just think it's so topical. It's really relevant and top of mind for many of us these days. You know, I'd love to start actually kind of as the company did with the hamburger. You know, from your perspective, why did the alternative meat movement really start gaining so much traction with reinventing the hamburger?
Well, I think I can jump in from kind of the mission perspective. When Pat Brown founded our company, he did not have a background in food systems or food manufacturing per se. He actually came over from a tenured position at Stanford. He was a biochemist. And coming from science, you know, the jump for him was very, very logical, because when he founded the company, he wasn't doing it to get into food manufacturing. He was doing it because he wanted to address really big environmental issues associated with climate change, associated with catastrophic biodiversity loss, the use of our water resources to go into these big livestock systems. And so for him, it was really this market solution. It was very much a means to an end. How do we, at a really broad scale, steer ourselves away from these environmentally incredibly, incredibly impactful categories of food? So from that perspective, you really have to start with beef. You have to start with figuring out how you can create a more sustainable version of something that uses enormous amounts of natural resources globally, not just in the United States. And you have to do it in a way that consumers really want to actually eat it, and they'll actually substitute your product for beef. And so starting with hamburger was a way to address kind of a worst first strategy, saying, look, we know that cattle dominates these impacts associated with global deforestation, associated with huge amounts of feed, corn, soy, that go into keeping them alive for a year and a half to 2 years or more if it's dairy. And for the climate issues associated with methane production, manure management, it's the best possible way that you can, as a food system actor, address these problems. And so in addition to that, in addition to having, you know, a really great impact on the environment, if you can freeze or reduce consumption of beef from cows, it's also just culturally iconic. And I think that was really important for us to not only build the brand, but access as many consumers as we possibly could. And I think Danielle probably has a lot of really good insights on that as to, you know, what is it about this product that really enabled us to scale and take off in this way?
Yeah, exactly, Rebecca. I think when thinking about why we chose a burger specifically, it does have a lot to do with the cultural significance of the burger in America. Burgers are iconic and all around the globe are associated with Americans, and for good reason. Americans buy approximately 30 billion pounds of ground beef per year. Wow. And of that, the slight majority is sold at restaurants, just over 50%, and the remainder through grocery stores and other channels. And so the way that we brought the burger to market was really unique and very thoughtful. We debuted the Impossible Burger in 2016 at the restaurants of just a few of America's top chefs, in particular, those who had previously been known for their love of animal products, like David Chang and Michael Simon. you know, we knew that we were just a kind of random new food company, but these chefs had already won the trust and the ears of consumers. So we knew that people would be much more likely to give the product a chance once these big names gave us the stamp of approval, rather than just doing our own advertising or try to appeal to people to change their habits in a different way. And so that was 2016. Since then, we've obviously quickly gone more and more mainstream. First was to regional favorites, you know, local chains like Bear Burger in New York or Hop Daddy in Texas or Gott's here in the Bay Area. And then we went mass market, starting with White Castle back in 2018, Burger King in 2019. And then later in 2019, we started our real retail rollout as we're expanding into brick and mortar retailers and really awesome new partnerships like with Imperfect Foods right now.
Amazing. Yeah, thank you for that segue. As this episode airs, you can officially get an Impossible Burger in your Imperfect order. So do definitely keep an eye out for that if you are listening or a customer. I really love that intro you both gave. That's really helpful because I think I at first found it kind of odd I found it fascinating how this movement had fixated so much on the hamburger. But with what you've laid out, it really makes sense. I mean, from a climate standpoint, we need to figure out beef and also just... Yeah, in terms of an entry point into the market, yeah, what a familiar, iconic, and kind of beloved American thing that if we're going to reinvent meat, why not start with a hamburger? I think that's super insightful. You know, for any kind of skeptics listening, can we dig into why exactly are plant-based meats so preferable to animal protein when it comes to resource consumption and climate change?
Absolutely. I think... it really comes down to just animal metabolisms, right? I mean, it's nothing inherently wrong with animals themselves. It's the fact that when you're feeding global demand, which is enormous right now, there's about 1 trillion pounds of animal meat that is consumed every year globally. You have to kind of reckon with the fact that these types of categories of food just are way higher up in the food web than eating something that's coming directly off of the field, eating plants. The reason for that is if you look at a cow, and we're probably going to keep on talking about cows because they're the worst offenders on this, they're alive for a long period of time. And so they're eating and, you know, excreting across that whole lifespan, whether it's 1 year, 2 years, 6 years for dairy. And it's that animal is having to eat soy, corn, distillers, grains, alfalfa forage, pasture inputs, a lot of inputs that go into sustaining that animal over that time period. Now, of course, we only eat like half of that animal too. So in addition to the fact that they're alive for a long time, they're metabolizing, they're burning calories. They're also creating things that we don't eat and that we don't necessarily use, bones, offal, hides, which, you know, can go to leather. But the conversion efficiency, looking at it purely from that perspective, is really, really poor. To the point where for 1 pound of beef that is on your plate, it has lost 97% of the calories, the energy, and the protein that were contained within the plants that the cow ate as it kind of delivered that meat to you. So there's only a 3% efficiency for these products. So there's nothing, you know, inherently wrong with this cow. It's the idea of scale and feeding demand. And the reason that we see statistics like, you know, 30 to 50% of the ice-free surface of the planet is covered by animal farming, especially grazing. Animal farming requires 1/3 of all freshwater. And animal farming is responsible for as many greenhouse gas emissions as the entire global transportation industry, is because of that metabolic bottleneck. It's just difficult to, you know, be able to feed that level of demand when you're converting it through a system that really wasn't designed for it. So by going directly to the plants themselves without having that stage in between, we can be much more sustainable. And for the Impossible Burger, we recently launched the Impossible Sausage, and I'll have these numbers shortly. But for the Impossible Burger, a little bit of a misnomer, it's actually a ground beef. You can kind of use it however you would a typical ground beef application. We use 96% less land area in a year, generate about 89% lower greenhouse gas emissions, and use about 87% less water. And you can do that simply because you don't have to translate all of these inputs through an animal that lives for many years.
Wow. The raw math you just laid out is pretty mind-blowing. I mean, I spent some time on your website while prepping for this episode and was digging into these stats, and they're truly mind-blowing. If folks haven't checked these out, you got to look at them. The numbers kind of speak for themselves. And I mean, I'm a big fan of analogies. So I was just thinking as you were saying that, this idea that there's a 97% loss, like you get 3% of what you put in. Like imagine if someone's like pitching a savings account to you and they're like, you know, like, oh, you put $100 in and you'll end up with $3. It's like, no, that sounds terrible. Like what a terrible yield. And obviously
there's not many industries you can get away with this in.
No, I guess that's what I was really thinking about is like there are, it is kind of ludicrous in the grand scheme of things when you think about this, that meat is this industry that we're somehow okay with that level of inefficiency, whereas in every other industry, we're like, oh, no, we got to get more efficient and more efficient. And, you know,
well, it's and just, to be fair, there hasn't been a good alternative. I think that's the game changer with Impossible Burger was Pat Brown's company created something where we didn't have that ability to change in consumer behavior. Yeah. It's really hard to shift off of diets. And it comes back to that.
That's a really good point. And also, I mean, not to like critique cows, like there's only so efficient cows can be, right? And so we shouldn't like you said earlier, the problem is not inherently cows. It's that the way we've built this whole system of raising them. And, you know, and my understanding is actually a lot of the really bad externalities of cattle manufacturing come from this drive to efficiency. You know, when you look at like feedlots and all the manure and waste those create, like that's in part for us trying to make up for the lack of efficiency inherent in the system. So I just love this idea that you're kind of lopping off that whole inefficiency by just skirting around it and really, you know, digging into the plant-based alternative that it didn't exist before. I think that's huge. I think this is groundbreaking. I mean, what an exciting decade we're coming into for folks looking to eat plant-based. You know, I'd love to dig into who's your target audience? Like, who would you say the impossible ground beef or the burger is for? Like, who are you marketing towards?
Yeah, our target consumers are meat eaters. And in fact, 9 out of 10 of our customers are self-identified as such, as meat eaters. Impossible Foods, we like to say, makes meat for meat lovers so that they don't have to compromise on taste, nutrition, or sustainability. And luckily, as that stat reflects, the people that we were targeting are actually the same as the people that ended up being our customers. So we don't cater to vegans or vegetarians because they're already eating low on the food chain, so to say, and so sustainably. They're kind of already doing what we want for more people to be doing, which is to be eating a largely plant-based diet. So in terms of marketing, we don't really focus on that population because they're kind of already along for the ride. So what we're trying to do is to win over the rest of the population by lowering the barriers to eating plant-based by baking an extremely delicious product. And, you know, in terms of surprises, in many ways, the deliciousness of our product does still surprise a lot of people, which is kind of a joy that never gets old. We hear a lot of stories about folks in restaurants sending their order back, insisting they were served a regular burger, or people fooling their spouse with an Impossible Burger. I think a lot of people have come to know that toothpick flag that frequently comes in your Impossible Burger as this kind of iconic Instagrammable image, which I think was the original marketing intention when we created it. And in the last few years, it's served just a tremendously utilitarian purpose. So that's like the way that restaurants and servers distinguish this is the beef and this is the Impossible. And like, we promise that's the Impossible one in front of you because I put that toothpick flag in. Yeah. So that is kind of a fun surprise that still happens on a regular basis.
That's really interesting. I mean, what you said, you know, the analogy that comes to mind is it sounds like you're almost going after the meat equivalent of swing voters, right? Like the vegans and vegetarians are kind of your base. Like they're already eating in a really environmentally sustainable way.
Yeah.
But there is this persuadable middle that exists in diet. And I mean, I think that's brilliant. Like you have to get those people to at least eat less meat, if not, you know, stop the consumption. If you're talking about how do you have a maximum impact, right, with diet.
Exactly. And I think the awesome thing is that while you're right, like the hardliners, the vegans and vegetarians are already there, the addressable market is actually much bigger than people expect it to be. It really isn't just flexitarians. When we say 9 out of 10, that is actually, that's full on true. Over 90% of folks out there have either, you know, that have tried it are meat eaters, meaning that every single person out there is a potential customer. There's no one that we're excluding by being a really delicious meat made from plants. So it's really awesome to see that we're working on the 90%+ of everyone else, not just the, you know, however many percents are self-identified as flexitarians, or I'm trying to eat less and so on.
That's really awesome. And I love what you said about deliciousness too. And that's actually a commonality I've noticed amongst a lot of our podcast guests is when you're talking about building a sustainable, whether it's a nonprofit or a business, often like deliciousness is the best persuader. Like you can have the best data and metrics and mission in the world, but if your core product isn't delicious, it's very hard to actually get people to adopt and change their habits. Because, you know, diet is so personal, right? And I think that's just fascinating that you're addressing something that's really hardwired into us and a lot of people are reluctant to change. And yet you've shown that there does exist this curiosity in the American public.
Yeah, exactly.
That's super interesting. You know, let's talk about using this in the kitchen because it's new territory for a lot of people. And I think a lot of people have bad associations with veggie burgers. They've had a really bland or underwhelming one in the past. So what tips do you have for cooking with the Impossible Burger in the kitchen?
Yeah, that's a great segue. You know, you mentioned veggie burgers that people either have a bad cooking experience or that's why people have previously been reluctant because those were never really that focused on deliciousness. They were focused on we need to appeal to people who don't want to eat animals right now. So we took a completely different approach, which was we need this to be as good as meat so that people that are in it for taste come along for the ride here. In terms of cooking, by design, our product cooks very similar to ground beef and can easily be substituted into any ground meat recipe. And that versatility is really a core part of our whole product design. We needed it to not just taste like beef, which we achieved, but also to cook and handle and match the versatility of beef as well. So I'm proud to say that we did achieve that. And I think it is so important because that's what shows our consumers that there's really no need to turn back. There aren't exceptions about how it can be used or, okay, well, it's great as a burger, but I can't use it in this way. We can really truly say, use this instead of ground beef and you will be satisfied, full stop. There is one cool difference during cooking, if you want to get technical, which is about shrinkage. Ground beef from cows typically shrinks about 25% during cooking. Impossible barely shrinks at all. So you essentially get the same finished amount of product as when you started, which is great in the kitchen. And last thing, it can actually technically be eaten raw. Since it's just plants, there's no health risk to not cooking it. And in fact, Impossible Tartare is a thing that some high-end chefs have served. But we do recommend still treating and storing Impossible Burger similarly to how you would ground beef.
Wow, that's awesome. I had no idea about the shrinkage point. Is that because of water loss or why is that?
It is mostly related to the moisture and the fat content in meat and then conversely in our product. So we use coconut oil as our fat base. And so when coconut oil cooks off, it doesn't cook off in the same way as beef grease would, where the beef fat kind of cooks off and smokes out and disappears and loses a lot of the kind of initial matter that you started with. Ours kind of stays together more and doesn't lose much during the process.
Got it. And I appreciate the point you brought up about you don't have to worry about undercooking it because I think that's a real, we're recording this during grilling season, you know, in the summer. And that's something a lot of people worry about when cooking meat is they're kind of terrified of, oh, what if I undercook it? Is it going to be safe? And that's something I always remind people about. The beauty of cooking with vegetables is you never have to worry about that. It might not be the most delicious if you undercook it, but it's still totally safe to eat. So just
exactly
one worry dodged.
And on a grander scale, in terms of, you know, the reason it's safe to eat raw is because it is just made from plants. When you think about that a little further, it also means that there is no chance of slaughterhouse contaminants and no animal hormones that appear in the product. So there are, you know, additional things that are beneficial on a nutritional and frankly public health kind of scale coming from the same base reason.
Yep. I appreciate you bringing that up. This is like kind of not even a pet peeve. This is like a soapbox thing I've developed actually from this podcast. And we had Dana Gunders on, the food waste expert, and she made such a good point that we have this misconception in America that it's old food that makes you sick, right? That the idea of like the moldy strawberries in your fridge, like if you eat one of those, you're going to get salmonella. When actually it's to your point, it's contamination, poor handling, poor refrigeration. Like that's where all of these diseases are coming from. And so I think that's really important for people to know that like you don't need to fear stuff in your fridge that might just be a little bit old, but it's these bigger things about like, yeah, what's happening at the slaughterhouse? You know, what's happening when there's cattle next to where veggies are being grown and the manure? And, you know, it's like all of that stuff is where contamination happens. And I just appreciate you bringing that up too, because that's such an important part about our overall kind of dietary picture. Because I think like the things we're afraid of, that ends up shaping the impacts of our diet as much as the things we're eating, right? It's the things we're like weirdly, shy of. So yeah, I think that's really important. I'd love to talk about kind of the, you know, looking forward here, because it feels like we're reaching a tipping point with plant-based protein and with Impossible. You know, you're really taking off. Like you said, you're available in retailers, like brick and mortar stores, you're available at Imperfect, you're available in so many restaurants now. You know, how do you see Impossible fitting into the future of the American food system?
Yeah, that's a great question that can be approached in a couple of different ways. You know, from a consumer perspective, in some ways, it doesn't really change at all. As we just discussed, the taste and experience with this meat is no different than conventional meat, and that's kind of the point. So if we achieve our goal, in some ways, people's day-to-day experience with products is really similar to right now. But when speaking about the future, I think you have to think about who's in it. And we're definitely seeing the plant-based movement take hold, especially in younger generations. We did a study last year on generational trends in plant-based meat, and the results showed striking differences among age groups. We learned that while 2 in 10 baby boomers in the U.S. consumes plant-based meat at least once a month, more than half of the U.S. Gen Z population consumes plant-based meat at least once a month. And, you know, I think we could have assumed that younger people are more likely to eat plant-based meat than older generations. But we also learned that the trend is really quickly accelerating as millennials become parents and also start to imbue future generations with these same habits. So I think that the acceleration is really there, in the future is just going to be more and more plant-based. So, you know, of course, there's this huge shift underway where restaurants and retailers and distributors are therefore moving to meet these customer and consumer demands around being provided a plant-based option. When we first launched the Impossible Burger, it was very much a specialty item, not just because it was mostly available at those celebrity chefs I mentioned earlier, but it really was a big sell for restaurants that were going to be the first one in their state or maybe the only one in their city to serve this really novel, cool, hot product. And with shifting consumer expectations and our own company growing and being available in more places, the value proposition is really different now. Hmm. It used to be the exception to see it on a menu, and that would be a special thing to go out of the way for. But now it's still really important to pay attention to, because it's now just an expectation. People expect to see a plant-based option on the menu. So really not having a plant-based offering, whether it's in your restaurant or on your physical or digital retail shelves, is really just an oversight now that could be losing a lot of revenue from potential consumers. And so that really brings me to the real key goal of our mission, which is to be ubiquitous in the same way that meat from animals is ubiquitous. And that's a cornerstone of our ability to ultimately be truly competitive against the incumbent industry of animal meat.
Wow.
I think that that ubiquity point also, it gets to the environmental necessity and urgency to include plant-based meat as part of that future food system, right? I don't think we can get around it. I mean, I really do think that this is an inevitable outcome and a necessary one, because the environmental urgency of climate change, of the fact that we have lost more than half of the wild animal populations on this planet over the past 40 years, by and large, as a result of deforestation from how we feed ourselves very inefficiently. As you know, just a global citizenship, like, we need to be able to create alternatives, but where you're not compromising on things like your food culture. It's funny because I'm seeing a lot of similarities between Imperfect Foods and between Impossible Foods on a couple of things, and specifically around resilience. So as I said, it is necessary for us to change the way that we eat in order to avoid catastrophic climate outcomes, in order to avoid the loss of ecosystem services that we get from nature, from wild animals, from preserving habitats, because we're basically erasing those landscapes. If we scale up meat consumption to the 70, 80, 90% increase that we're going to see over the next several decades, failing to provide these alternatives will compromise livelihoods. And so it's this wicked irony that in order for livestock systems to even continue to be viable, we need alternatives to them because the environmental consequences are dire. Now, all of this said, that idea of resilience and agility is really important because what we've seen, especially with COVID, especially with coronavirus, which has been a really powerful testing force for food systems and our current kind of status quo, the capital that we've invested within how we feed ourselves right now, we're seeing that the way that the food system is structured is not particularly suited to adapting to these crises, and that the current system, especially around animal farming, is a massive risk factor in creating those dynamics, and that the systems simply aren't agile enough to respond to the disruptions that they, to some extent, you know, create. And so when we talk about building back better, we have to start with food, because it's all about how we use our land, how we protect the natural resources that provide these ecological fire breaks, right, that protect people and livelihoods against pandemics, but also in our response to them. So something that was really interesting for me to kind of observe as a third party was seeing how Imperfect was able to get produce off of farmers' fields and get a revenue stream to these farmers who had seen their supply chain basically collapse as markets, their market collapsed because restaurants were shuttered. So when the food service industry shrunk hugely, there was an enormous amount of contraction within that industry, and we're still seeing it right now. That was a really big challenge and a really big threat to farmers. And it was interesting seeing how Imperfect could kind of turn on a dime and had that innate agility within supply chains to be able to link them to markets in a way that big consolidated actors really were not. I think that was something where we're going to probably, I hope, see more of that ability to react and that resilience in the future, both for the ways that we get foods to market in the model of Imperfect, but also in the way that we need to move away from these consolidated livestock operations that pose massive ecological and public health risks. You know, we need these new systems, including Impossible Foods, but the whole alternative meat industry to step in where those systems have failed. And we need to lend that inherent agility, whether it's in the ingredients that we choose, the regions we source from, into new modes of feeding people that serve more people, all the way from product to distribution. So it's going to be, I think the future of food is around resilience. It's around how do we adapt to what we know about climate change? How do we really act on that to put the brakes on it, find ways that we can turn the clock back on climate change, which you can by avoiding eating livestock products, reducing emissions. In theory, you're sparing land for more carbon capture, pulling it out of the atmosphere, and also in just how we get food to market. So that is going to be really interesting to observe, I think, over the next couple of years. And I think we've got some really good actors in the industry, and it's going to be great to see how this all scales.
Wow, that's an amazing... I don't even want to call it a tangent because that was such a necessary place for us to go. No, I mean, thank you so much for sharing that. I think what you're talking about is really huge. And I think the key word you talked about, resilience, like that's definitely been a takeaway for me and actually all of us at Imperfect from COVID, is that look, like the future of supply chains have to be flexible, resilient, compassionate, agile, because what we've seen, again, to your point, is, you know, Imperfect as a company emerged quite literally because grocery stores sourcing systems were so big and clunky and one size fits all that billions of pounds of perfectly good fruits and veggies were getting wasted, getting undervalued, getting left in fields, getting sent to animal feed for no reason. And so, you know, that's like literally in our DNA as a company, is like, we need to solve that type of problem. And I think, yeah, COVID was just such another rock to the system that made all of this, all of kind of the flaws in our food supply chains even more apparent. And so, yeah, I love that you underlined that. And I that's a hope I have, and I think all of us have going forward, is let's create a system that's more resilient, that can bounce back from setbacks, and also leaves a little bit of a lighter footprint, you know, because our food industry is such a huge tax on the environment. But the flip side to your point is there's a silver lining there. You know, I was doing some reading in prep for this episode. And, you know, Drawdown, the climate research group, estimates that two of the biggest low-hanging fruits for addressing climate change are a plant-based diet and reducing food waste. And I mean, that's why, you know, we're all here right now. But I think that's also just such an empowering thing to think about is that, yeah, like the low-hanging fruit is there. Like, we can pick it. Like, it's here. Let's do it. Let's capitalize. And, you know, to your point, Danielle, that it's about changing what the default option is, or at least, you know, providing different, better options for folks. And that's like another commonality I've seen from a lot of our guests is if you're talking about making a really positive, sustainable change, you have to change the menu of options. Because if there isn't a sustainable option, if there isn't a plant-based option, you can't choose it, right? So real power is not choosing from the menu, it's setting the menu.
Yeah, and I love that you mentioned the Drawdown project, because I think John Foley is one of the people who introduced me to the notion that should have been intuitive, but that not all food waste and food loss is created equal too. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at these environmental footprint statistics, the last thing that you ever want to lose or waste is animal products, right? Yes. Because you are embodying so many resources. And so there are so many low-hanging fruits on this. At the same time, there's a lot of lift that's still needed. There's a lot of investment that's needed to scale these industries. And I hope there's a sufficient market signal to see that really take over with future of food, because we do need new systems. We can't just keep on iterating on what we have now because it's not going to work.
Yeah, you're really well said. And I hate to keep doing this like commonalities thing, but that is another actual takeaway I've had from a lot of different podcast guests, or we're about to get to them. But in the closer, we always ask folks, what's your least favorite thing to waste? And increasingly people say meat for exactly the reasons you've outlined. And I think that's huge. And I'm so glad that that consciousness is out there now that, yeah, all food waste is not created equal. Like, again, wasting any type of food is on some level an environmental sin. Like, we should avoid it. However, wasting that apple versus wasting a chunk of cheese or, you know, God forbid, a hamburger patty, like, that's, different consequences for sure. Wow. And really, really powerful stuff. You know, is there anything else you want to share about kind of what's coming next for Impossible Foods?
Yeah, there's a lot of exciting stuff coming soon. As we've said with Ubiquity, our long-term goal is still to be available everywhere conventional meat is sold, meaning every market, every channel, every geographical region in the world. And we've kind of still, we're just getting started. So 2020 was always supposed to be our big year to expand into retail. We really started last September with about 200 retail locations. And as we're speaking now, we're in over 5,000 and we're only halfway through the year of 2020. So, you know, we were planning on a big retail expansion, but certainly the COVID crisis accelerated that a lot, which is great that we, as you know, per what Rebecca was just speaking about, we're able to meet the consumers where they needed us and get a spot on the shelf, get a spot in e-commerce retailers and so on to bring plant-based meats into people's homes directly while the food service industry contracted. So 2020 is definitely our big retail year, which means it's our big home cooking year, creating a lot more convenience for people to bring home plant-based products, learn how to cook with them, get comfortable with it, really understand the versatility. And I think this is the beginning of the next generation of Impossible fans and eaters who don't just have the one favorite place where they go get it at the restaurant, but now they have their favorite dish to serve to their families. And it's really a whole new thing that hasn't been explored before in our company. And so in the near future, we'll continue to scale production of the Impossible Burger and expand the availability of our newest product, which is the Impossible Sausage, also made from plants, which just launched at more than 20,000 restaurants just earlier this month, including all Starbucks in the U.S. And as a breakfast croissant witch at Burger King. So we're about new channels, new places, new products, and there's only more to come.
Wow. I love that. That's amazing. Really exciting stuff. And I love that, you know, 2020 was going to be a big year. And even despite all these interruptions, it seems like you're still making it a huge year for the company. That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
So cool. I mean, wow, that's really inspiring note to end on here. I'd love to get to the speed round now, which are some fun closer questions to get to know you both a little bit better. You ready to go?
Maybe. We'll see.
We're about to learn a lot about your karaoke preferences. Woo! Okay. First off, is there anything you'd encourage folks listening to follow up with or explore in more depth on their own time?
I always encourage people to just take a look at some of the materials from like the FAO, the Food and Ag Organization under the UN, around the total impact of eating meat, and especially around biodiversity. So I know that doesn't speak to everyone. We've actually done some consumer testing around this, and we know that people have a tough time connecting their plate to conservation, connecting plate to planet in general. But I think once you really kind of look into it, it's really eye-opening. And it fleshes out a lot of the other important conversations that are had around food and sustainability, like food miles and local purchasing and that kind of thing. You can kind of see the scale at which this is so impactful. So that would be, I think, the thing that I would encourage people to take a look at.
What's a positive change you've made in your life in the past year that you think folks listening should try?
Oh, that is tough.
Yeah, because we've all made so many changes in the last few months.
many of them involuntary.
I think this is probably not at all unique to me, but just the slowing down, right? That we've all, a lot of us have been kind of forced into it, and some, you know, some people are in better situations than others, and I think I'm in quite a good position. But that just kind of slowing of everything that resulted when shelter in place took place, especially in the Bay Area. We were a really conservative region. It pretty much the only thing we had to do was stay inside or go for walks. And turns out that's actually kind of a great thing that you can do. But it's hard to answer. Like Danielle said, there are so many things that have changed massively. I can't even remember a baseline anymore.
Yeah, I don't remember what I used to do. So I don't know about the last year, but in the last few months, one habit that I've developed more recently that I'm really happy about is actually doing a 10 to 15 minute morning stretch, just a bit of yoga stuff that I've accumulated, a bit of stretching. And I do find that it's made a big difference in my mornings, and building a habit out of the nothingness that we've been given in the last few months has been really important in and of itself, even though it's so small. So I've really enjoyed that.
My answer is that I aspire to do what Danielle is doing, 10 to 15 minutes of like mindful yoga and stretching. That is a really good practice.
What a great coworker to have that inspires positive habits in you. That's awesome. I got to try that. Definitely good way to get the mornings going. If you're cooking for somebody and you want to make them feel loved, what are you going to make for them?
My favorite thing to make that has definitely been a major part of the household during this whole quarantine is kimchi fried rice. It is so comforting, so good, really, really delicious. There is a fried egg on top, and I cannot recommend it enough. I use the New York Times recipe.
That is so good sounding. I am a terrible cook. I'm just not great. I'm a great assembler. I can like take things and put them together. So I'm big on produce. But my partner is from Brazil. And so like I try to steer toward things that are like culturally relevant. So lots of fresh juices and stuff. So that's where I try to contribute. But if I tried to really cook a full meal, I don't think that would make anyone feel loved.
Too hard on yourself. The fresh juices are their own gift as well. You know, no, there's no recipe too simple in my book.
Fair enough.
What ingredient could you not live without, and why?
This is such a basic answer, but I mean, onions and garlic. Like, what would we do? What would we do without these? A few years ago, I had heartburn for the first time, and I asked my doctor what's going on. And she said, you should try cutting out onions, garlic, tomatoes, coffee, and chocolate. And I walked right out of there.
That's evil. Can't do that. I can't live without hot sauce, like habanero hot sauce. It probably speaks to my inability to cook, but, that's it for me. I can't give it up.
Amazing. Is there a brand you particularly seek out?
No, I mean, back in the days when we traveled, we would spend a lot of time in Brazil and Mexico, and I would just load up on anything from the shelves and then bring it back. So we're slowly kind of going through that stockpile, but zero brand loyalty.
Amazing. Definitely. Got to have a good hot sauce around. And what is your least favorite thing to waste?
I think for me, it's like seasonal produce, just because I grew up in Minnesota. Like, I'm from a place that does not have a huge diversity of fruits and vegetables, generally speaking, compared to where I live now in California. I think like the first time I heard about like what a persimmon was like in The Adventures of Huck Finn or something. And then finally, like actually seeing these products in California, where I went to school for agriculture. So it kills me if I like accidentally waste things like mission figs or persimmons or things in my fridge that land there that, you know, 10 years ago before I lived in a place where I had easy access to this stuff. It kills me to see that go to waste. So I try to be pretty judicious about it, but it's tough. It's end of, you know, like consumer stage food loss is a tough one. And I am definitely guilty of some of that for sure.
My least favorite thing to go to waste is stuff that is either visibly or maybe even markedly is quote unquote expired. I grew up in a household. My parents are immigrants from the former Soviet Union, and expiration dates meant absolutely nothing. And as a kid, I thought that was so weird. And I tried to say like, no, this has to be bad. And as an adult, it now drives me crazy when I notice other people very superficially discarding food because someone said that you should probably use it within a few days and there's nothing markedly wrong with it. And I know, Riley, actually on a different podcast, you had talked about we need to create federal standards for expiration dates and things like that that are really impactful to the food system. And people are doing their best in their house. They don't want to get sick. They throw things out, but it's a huge problem, way higher up the supply chain of how we use expiration dates and what good really is it doing. So I am definitely guilty of keeping things far past, but I've never gotten sick because you just have to be careful.
100%. I appreciate that. And I would add also that your body has a wonderful way of telling you if something's so good to eat. If it smells bad or tastes gross, don't eat it. But if it smells good and tastes fine to eat. You know, we've evolved to keep ourselves safe, I always like to say. And you know, yeah, we've done a lot of work trying to spread that knowledge. You know, this February we did a whole campaign called Stop Dating Your Food. That was kind of a tongue-in-cheek Valentine's Day joke, but it was also serious that there's a lot of low-hanging fruit again we can all address if we think differently about expiration date. So yeah, that's a great point. I appreciate you bringing that up. Lightening the mood a bit here, what is your go-to karaoke song?
My go-to karaoke song is Case of the X by Maya. It is something that I have sung every single time that I've done karaoke, and I am still never not out of breath and incapable of singing it by like 35% of the way through, but it is so much fun.
Epic.
I cannot even compete with that. I think that like that is the perfect answer. I would never subject anyone, much like my cooking, I would never subject anyone to my karaoke, but like anything from the early 2000s is squarely within my request list. I will listen to any of that.
Amazing. And who is somebody you admire tremendously, and what do you admire about them?
Is it too silly if we both say Pat Brown?
Right? Is that a little on the nose? It's immediately where my brain goes, though.
Same.
I don't think so. I mean, it's speak your truth, you know?
I think, like, in addition to Pat, which, like I think he's just top of mind for both of us, but I'm really incredibly impressed by just youth movements in general right now, both in terms of racial equity, class equity, food sovereignty, climate action. Like, I am just grateful, like coming from a generation that came before them, thinking about like what I was doing at that time and the just level of motivation that they have. I'm impressed and grateful because this is not their job, right? Like, it's not their job to pull us out of the gutter across every different category. And yet they're willing to do it. To push and ask for better. So I think like to totally just not one individual, but just in general, that movement I'm so impressed by, and really motivated by.
100%. Definitely agree.
That's an incredible point, Rebecca. I think especially between food justice, environmental justice, what we saw last year with Greta Thunberg, what we're seeing this year with BLM, it really is, the kids are all right, is I think what we've all been saying. And it is so true. And you're right, it's not their job. And everyone that came before should have done better, but it's great to see that they're up to the challenge. And I feel like my future is in good hands, if that's who's going to be here.
Definitely. And finally, what are you grateful for this week?
I am grateful that we are happy and healthy and that my colleagues are employed and still my teammates. I think we're in a pretty privileged position right now, and just seeing the total global context, it's hard to not feel grateful about anything you have right now.
I 100% spot on agree. I'm grateful every day that I get to still work at a company that is still making an impact, and I have been so therefore protected from some of the worst case scenarios that so many other people and friends and family have been seeing in these last few months. So I'm really just grateful every day that we can continue working like this.
Amazing. You know, Rebecca and Danielle, thank you so much for joining us today. Where can folks learn more about you and the work that you do?
If you want to learn a little bit more about how, personal choice can really add up to really big, great things for the environment, you can look at www.impossiblefoods.com/impact, which has our impact calculator on it, looking at, consumer substitution behavior and how all of us making, easy choices together can add up to really great outcomes for climate and biodiversity and water use. That would be my recommendation.
Yeah. And if you're looking for where to actually go enjoy an Impossible Burger, whether at a restaurant, delivery, or picking it up at a local grocery store, you can go to impossiblefoods.com/locations and search for what's nearby in your area.
Perfect. Thank you so much. We'll have links to everything we talked about today, including a lot of the awesome studies and organizations and research on our website, in the show notes of this episode. If you check out unwastedpodcast.com or our newly launched content site, thewholecarrot.com, this episode will be up there. And if you're listening, have any comments or questions, just shoot us an email at feedback@unwastedpodcast.com. Danielle and Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great chatting with you.
Thank you so much, Riley.